Well, hello everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am managing editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I have the true pleasure of introducing a new podcast for MHE, hosted by Perry Cohen. It's called Conversations with Perry and Friends. Perry is a longtime friend of MHE and a longtime editorial advisory board member of the publication. He is CEO of the Pharmacy Group, and has let's just say decades of experience in managed care. Perry is a pharmacist by training. He created a pharmacy benefit management company for Aetna in the early 90s before the world knew what a PBM was. And he has relationships with literally hundreds of decision makers in the United States healthcare system. Perry was a founder of the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy. We call it AMCP. Past president of AMCP and a fellow of the organization. Perry holds a Bachelor of Science degree in pharmacy and a doctorate of pharmacy degree from the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. So Perry, I'm really so psyched that you're going to be on the airwaves, joining the podcast trend, and looking forward to hosting conversations with Perry and friends here at MHE. So take it away.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks for the opportunity to host the podcast. For my first episode, we want to talk about the impact of government on the delivery and financing of healthcare in 2025 and beyond. It's a top-of-mind issue here in February 2025. So I said, who's the best person I can find in the United States to come on board with me, one of my friends, to talk about the impact of government on delivery and financing? And when you think about that, you got to think about Medicaid. And you got to think about Medicare. So I went to my friend John Baucus. John was the CEO of LA Care Health Plan, his most recent job. He's got 48 years of experience doing managed care around the country. And in his most recent job at CEO of LA Care that he left on January 6th, he had managed $11 billion in revenue for 2.6 million Medicaid recipients in Los Angeles County in California. So with that background, he's the perfect person for today. Hi, John. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Perry. Thanks for having me be for your first guest.
Absolutely, absolutely. John, I've been good friends for over 20 years. So I got a couple of questions that are on my mind, John, and I want to just pick your brain and maybe the people can benefit from it. All these changes we're hearing about with the government impacting delivery and financing of healthcare that's going on right now. My first question is, what is the impact going to be on the patient?
Well, it's going to depend on which plastic card the patient has in their wallet. If your listeners don't know, we ration healthcare in the United States by that plastic card. And the easiest way to think about it is there are four main buckets that you could get a card from. One is employer-based health insurance, which your employer provides, and you may participate in the cost of it through payroll deduction, and that's sold by commercial insurance companies. Then there's Medicare for people who are over 65 or disabled, which is 100% funded by the federal government, and generally comes with fairly generous benefits. And then there is Medicaid, which is the program, needs-based program based on income for people who are below a certain ceiling, and that varies from state to state. And the care there is wildly different. Access to providers is more limited. There are no out-of-pocket expenses for the beneficiary, but it's the quality of care that they're able to access that's a real differential. And then we also have a cohort of people who get their insurance by being part of the military in TRICARE. So three of these four buckets are totally funded by the taxpayers. And then we have a smidge of a bucket for people who buy their insurance off the individual market exchange created by the Affordable Care Act. That's about 20 million. But if you take Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, and the marketplace, you have got 50% of the population is dependent on a government-funded health insurance. So if there are going to be changes in the federal financing of healthcare, it's going to impact all four of those sectors. There will be a reverberation for the commercial insurers. And we could get into a whole nother discussion about how commercial insurers are, in a sense, subsidizing the cost of Medicaid. But that's another question.
Okay, so that impacts the financing of healthcare for these people, for the patients. Any ideas on how it's going to impact delivery of healthcare or their access to delivery?
Absolutely. Let's look at Medicaid because that is our largest program of the four government-funded programs. Medicaid is the largest with close to 80 million people right now, and then there are about 68 million in Medicare, and then there are 14 million that are both. They have Medicare and Medicaid. They're called dual eligibles. But for the folks that rely on Medicaid, we have the worst outcomes in terms of quality for that population. And it's directly related to the fact that the reimbursement to providers who participate in Medicaid is at the bottom of all of those categories. And as a result, not every provider in every community will take a Medicaid patient because they say economically they can't, and so they just don't have them at all. So we have a smaller pool of providers, and it now falls to what we would call the safety net providers to provide the bulk of that care. And those are providers who practice physically, whether it's a doctor's office or a hospital, that's around where concentrations of Medicaid beneficiaries live. And since Medicaid is a program based on means and you cannot exceed a certain level, wherever we have pockets of poor people, there are going to be more Medicaid beneficiaries, and therefore the access is going to be more limited. Now, Perry, you and I are sitting here in Los Angeles right now, and we could go out to Santa Monica, and there's a doctor on every corner. You could go to South LA, and you might have to go six blocks between a doctor's office or even further between a hospital. So access is a big contributor to some of the quality issues that affect people who rely on Medicaid. Then there's a whole another racial component in that many of the folks who are on Medicaid, there's probably a higher concentration of people of color, whether they're Black or Latino, particularly here in Los Angeles. And yet the number of providers that we have participating does not reflect the population. And there has been an enormous amount of research that shows that if you have a culturally relevant provider to you, you're going to get better outcomes. So if you're seeing a provider that's the same race, ethnicity, or speaks the same first language, you're largely going to get a better outcome, basically because you trust the person that sounds like you, looks like you, or so forth, and you're willing to share more information. So that's a whole nother, again, program we could have on culturally competent care. But I do think that anything that's going to mess with the financing of Medicaid and the reimbursement to providers, you're going to have less providers willing to participate, and access will again become an issue for people in that particular bucket. Medicare is better, and part of the differences is that Medicare pays more to providers, and some of us have for saying for a long time what we need is parity in the payments between Medicare and Medicaid. And that doesn't mean reduce Medicare. It means increase Medicaid to match Medicare. And you would have more providers participating. That would be a step one in trying to correct that deficiency that's there for the Medicaid population.
So that's given us a good perspective on patients and how the different buckets they are, if you will. But let's talk about providers. The way I was trained, they say if you want to make change in healthcare, just follow the money. That if you want hospitals to do something different, doctors to do something different, pharmacies just change the reimbursement, change where the money flows, and their behavior will change overnight. What's your perspective on all that with the providers and now with the government changes coming?
Well, let's say before we had worried about government changes, we had an issue with the safety net of providers, those that whose the bulk of their patients are based on Medicaid or people who have no insurance and it's uncompensated care. But they were already behind the eight ball in the sense that COVID came along and slammed them. Now, I've been trying to do some research on this, but I do believe that the population that is covered by Medicaid was had more deaths, more infections, more hospitalizations than the general population. So that slammed those safety net providers during the COVID pandemic. During the pandemic, we then had a lot of nurses leaving the field, which caused an increase in the cost of nursing, and that is now permanently embedded. At the same time, we had increased inflation as a result of coming out of the pandemic. So the safety net providers are already, I think, their backs are against the wall. Hospitals will tell you their cash reserves are not what they were pre-pandemic, and they have not had a chance to recover. So if you're a hospital or a clinic or a doctor's office that's predominantly seeing Medicaid patients, if there is not going to be, if there is going to be a reduction in the amount of money you're going to get for seeing these people, I think some of them will just be have to close shop. We will see hospitals closing. We will see doctors heading for the door or looking for practice positions where they're salaried and somebody else has to worry about where the money comes from. But I think that is our biggest challenge facing us. Now, the current administration has made a lot of noise, but they haven't proposed anything specifically. So it's a little hard to speculate on what might happen. But for instance, in one thing they're talking about, which is the amount of support that the federal government gives to the expansion population that was brought in under the Affordable Care Act, reduce that from 90% to 50%, that'll remove about $560 million a year from compensation that comes from the federal government to the states to pay the providers for that care. The states would then have to make that up or reduce the reimbursement to the providers.
So one statistic I learned about was that the federal government spends $1.9 trillion on healthcare programs in 2024. 1.9 trillion. And what's the role of the health plan, the local health plan, in leveling things out, access, quality, outcomes, cost, the payer sources, the needs of the providers and the patients. How do you define what the role of a well-run health plan should be in a local market?
Well, let's look at Medicaid. So Medicaid and Medicare were adopted, it'll be 60 years ago this year. And Medicare was for people over 65 or who were disabled and 100% paid for by the federal government. Medicaid was viewed always from the beginning as a program for the poor. And it was a 50-50 deal. If the states wanted to participate and get 50% reimbursement from the federal government, they had to throw in 50%. But the program was never funded at the same level of Medicare was in terms of the reimbursement schedules for providers. So it's always been, as I said, a program for the poor. I'm even have to go back to what you were asking.
No, so what's the role of the health
Oh, the
plan
health plan.
to
So
make all this
when
work?
okay, so when this started, I think people assumed that the government was running these programs. Well, they never were. Medicare was actually farmed out to Blue Cross plans to administer, and that became a whole other industry. So there was no army of government employees paying the claims. Medicaid was done at the state levels, and in that case, there were people at the states actually running the programs. Quickly, the states realized This isn't our thing, and they could not figure out how to control the cost. So they began to move to managed care probably about 40 years ago. And today, 40 of the 50 states rely on managed health care plans to operate their Medicaid programs, and California is one of them. So when I was at LA Care, we were one of about 26 plans in the state that had a contract with the state Medicaid agency to run the program for them. Now, why did they turn to us? They turned to managed care for the same reason employers turned to managed care. They thought it would control costs and it would also be able to measure quality so they'd know what they were paying for. So the states then became contract managers. The health plans took the risk. You get so much money and you figure out how to make it work. And I think it's because healthcare is not rocket science, it's harder. And that's where the role of the health plans comes in.
During Barack Obama's term as president, we saw the launching of the Affordable Care Act. So it's 10, 12 years, old based upon how you count the clock. What's the future of the Affordable Care Act going forward on access, cost, outcomes?
Well, I think the Affordable Care Act was a success in the sense that it expanded coverage in two ways by increasing the number of people who became eligible for Medicaid by increasing the ceiling of income a person could have. And again, because Medicaid is voluntary, the states had to agree to do that. And at the first blush, only about half the states were willing to do that, even though the feds paid 90% of that expansion coverage. But since then, we're now down to only 10 states that did not take it. The others figured out, that's a lot of money we're leaving on the table. It would help people who don't have insurance. And in a couple of states, it was done by ballot proposition, where the public said, no, we want this expansion. So I think that was a very helpful and a big success in terms of adding coverage. The other part of the Affordable Care Act was the individual market exchange, which was a way to make sure that people who didn't get employer-based insurance, didn't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, had a marketplace where they could get access to quality care and reasonable cost health insurance. So it set guidelines that are adhered to nationally. And 20 million people now have coverage that didn't have it before. And there's subsidies from the federal government, and some states like California added to those subsidies so that the vast majority of those people pay a very modest premium, and it's scaled. The more money you make, the more you pay personally. Here in California, there's some subsidy up to 600% of the federal poverty level. In most states, it's up to 400% of the federal poverty level.
You touch on a point, Medicaid managed care plans, right? Yeah, type of thing. Have they been successful in managing costs and quality?
Well, I think they have been writ large. Now, there are, of course, exceptions, and there'll be a scandal somewhere or something, but remember what managed care did, and Perry, you've been around as long as I have, that you couldn't remember. Before managed care, we paid bills, but we didn't know what we were paying for. Managed care ushered in the era that we're now in, where we do data collection, we do outcome reporting, and we now pay providers for improvements in those quality outcomes. So I think managed care did give us the benefit of measurement and accountability that was lacking before. Does that mean it's perfect? Of course not. We're in a mess. But we have tools now that we did not have before as a result of managed care. And bringing those tools to the Medicaid program through Medicaid managed care plans is what 40 states figured out they needed to do.
They say you can't manage what you can't measure, and you can't measure what you don't have data.
All right.
And so what you're telling me net net is managed Medicaid programs have generated a lot of data,
Right.
will give them the opportunity to measure performance, outcomes, whatever, and document what's going on inside the healthcare system.
Exactly.
Okay, so the state government, we have 50 states, they all do their best job. We have 50 governors. What role should they play in the health care of their citizens and their states?
Well, I think, most of the states are responsible for public health. I mean, we do have public health at the national level, but you know that most of the real public health issues are local. Do you have proper sanitation? Do you have
Water
sewers
safety,
and water and things of that nature? And I think the public health activities that the state does or the local communities do is very important, particularly when you have outbreaks of disease, which are very localized. How do you address and do that? So the state has a role there. The state's role, however, in terms of the health plans and the delivery of care, they license the doctors and hospitals. They make sure they're meeting quality standards. And the insurance plans are regulated by the states, not by the federal government. So the states do have an important role in this. And that regulation of the insurance plans includes the commercial insurers who provide the employer-based insurance. So they do have a big role.
So let's say you were brought in as the Secretary of HHS, and they said, John, what should we do to fix health care in the United States for all Americans? What would you do?
Well, first of all, I'd remind them that I know the difference between Part A and B of Medicare. And I know that Medicaid does not have a premium for its beneficiaries. Well, I think the number one thing I would do, if we're not going to have a single payer system, which I'm not advocating, but if we're going to stick with a system that we have now, then the first thing I would do would move to parity between reimbursement and Medicare and Medicaid.
You say parity, you mean reimbursement to physicians and
Reimbursement
hospitals
to
for
physicians
providing
and
care.
hospitals, yes. Because if you talk to a doctor's office or you talk to a hospital administrator, they will tell you Medicaid does not cover the cost of the care they provide. That means the paying professionals, paying for the physical plant, paying for all that stuff. Medicaid does not provide enough reimbursement to cover that. Medicare does. Now, can they make a lot of money on Medicare? Probably not. But the parity of bringing those up would begin to eliminate what I think is the biggest issue we have, is that people at the lower end of the scale who have the wrong plastic card in their wallet do not get access to the same care as other people. Here in Los Angeles, there are teaching hospitals that will not accept Medicaid patients. And when I was running at LA Care and we had somebody who needed a specialty service at one of those hospitals, we had to go negotiate a contract to admit one patient. That shouldn't be. We should be able to do it. Medicare, no problem. They will admit the patient. So I think that would be a fundamental thing that I would change, first of all.
I hear where you're going. Let's talk about the political reality in 2025. Is it really possible to get parity between Medicaid and Medicare?
Parity of reimbursement in the environment that I'm seeing now, I think would be impossible. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't still be our ultimate goal. And I would urge the new administration, if they're looking at ways to save money, is to look at the cost of not having the parity. What does that cost us later if people are denied access to care because the providers won't accept payment at that level? Do they wind up costing us more later down the road? What's the life expectancy that diminishes as a result of not people not having access to that, the economic benefit of them working and being a productive member of society?
Well, let's go back to my opening question about how this is all going to impact the patient and when and how does the patient access care? Do they go to their primary care doctor if they have one? Do they go to a hospital, a tertiary care hospital, an ER, an urgent care? That seems like there's a lot of choice for these people. but I guess it's not meeting the needs.
Well, there's a lot of choice for the general population. Again, in the Medicaid population, they don't have the same number of choices. There are less primary care doctors participating in Medicaid than there are in Medicare or commercial insurance. And that's why you see so many Medicaid patients use hospital emergency rooms for their care.
And aren't those the most expensive way to provide care?
That is the most expensive way to provide care, and it's also episodic because you see whoever is on duty.
Good.
Whereas if you have a primary care doctor that you can see on a regular basis, it's going to be somebody that understands you,
Okay.
understands your family,
Yes.
understands the economic situation you're in and how that affects your care.
All right, so let's stay on that theme for a moment. Let's talk about Medicare. I'm 70 years old. I'm a fee-for-service Medicare. I've got my card. I hear this thing called Medicare Advantage that people say it saves money, it costs money. Play that out for me. Should you're head of HHS, what should we do with Medicare Advantage and fee-for-service Medicare?
So Medicare was always a fee-for-service arrangement, but Medicare had some gaps in it. For instance, for many years didn't cover prescription drugs. It started that in 2006. So people who felt they needed more coverage would buy Medicare supplemental insurance, so they get other things cared for. But that was, again, still in the fee-for-service world. Medicare Advantage came along because it was a way to bring managed care into the Medicare marketplace by offering plans. And the federal CMS arranged it so that they would offer contracts to insurance plans to be able to offer this kind of program. And the government would pay the insurance company what they thought they would spend it on a fee-for-service basis and let the insurance company manage it. So many of the insurance companies figured that through managed care, they would be able to cut out unnecessary visits and offer extra stuff to make them attractive for the beneficiary to join that Medicare Advantage plan.
Okay.
And it's worked because the public has responded, and over 50% of Medicare beneficiaries now get their Medicare benefits through one of these plans called the
Okay.
Medicare Advantage plan.
So Medicare Advantage is a good thing?
Well, it's a good
Is it
thing.
that simple?
No, it's not that simple.
Okay.
Medicare Advantage costs more than fee-for-service Medicare, which has been pointed out time and time again by people who want to cut the program. But yet the quality, there's no way to measure the quality outcomes. Because we don't have the same measurements in
Right.
fee-for-service Medicare than we do in Medicare Advantage, where everything is measured. Now, I have to say, our industry has some bad actors in it. And at the beginning of Medicare Advantage, people kind of figured out quickly how to game the system
The health plans.
the health plans, because you would get a bench rate, and they figured out how to increase the bench rate by collecting more data to show that this patient was sicker than the average, so I should get paid more money.
All right. So I think I'm going to close with this question. And I ask a lot of people this question. It's for-profit versus not-for-profit healthcare, the role of publicly traded companies. Obviously, there's been some things lately where the individual has been fighting back on that. And that, to me, is even bigger than the federal government. So give us your line on for-profit versus not-for-profit healthcare and the role of the publicly traded companies.
I don't think I would frame it as profit versus nonprofit. I would think I would frame it more about what is the mission and business ethos of the organizers of it. Because not every for-profit plan, not every for-profit plan is bad. And not every
Not-for-profit's
Not for
good.
it's good.
Yeah,
So we have to
okay.
really look at the motivations behind it. I think what we saw in the recent backlash from the public after the CEO of United was murdered was really the frustration that the public has with the health plans and the entire system, regardless of whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit. And one of the things that was of great concern to me was how people are going after prior auths. authorizations, which were a hallmark of managed care, but it has drifted away from its original intent and has now become an irritant that we have to address.
Okay.
So I know we're out of time, but
All right.
you opened a door there.
Okay. So is the future bright for healthcare in the United States?
The future is bright for reform in healthcare.
Okay. Change is needed.
Change is needed.
Okay. Well, thank you, John. That was our first episode of The Impact of Government on the Delivery and Financing of Healthcare. Thank you, John Baucus.